evening. I'm Derek Fildebrand, publisher of the Western Standard, and you're watching The Pipeline. Today is March 29th, 2023. I want to welcome you all here, especially those of you watching us for the first time on the Wild TV network. Wild TV, Cowboy Channel, RDTV. We're really pleased to be on the network and reaching a whole new audience of people who care about, well, what we're going to talk about today. You're going to get a pretty good feel for us if you haven't heard us before. I'm joined, as usual, by the Western Standard's opinion editor, Nigel Hannaford. How are you, Nigel?
Great today. Good to be here.
Also got the Western Standard's senior Alberta columnist, Corey Morgan here. Corey, finally on cable.
Yeah, it's about time.
Yeah. And if you haven't seen it already, Corey Morgan, the Corey Morgan show itself is also got its standalone show on the Wild TV network, coming to you every week. A few times a week, actually. Fun. All right. Well, here's what we're talking about today. Earlier today, the Alberta NDP and the CBC accused Alberta Premier Danielle Smith of directly contacting and interfering in prosecutions for people in Alberta who have then who face charges under the Kenney government for not wearing a mask or protesting against lockdowns, various kinds of COVID-related charges like that. But it's a repeated accusation. Now, today there's an audio recording that came out of a conversation between Alberta Premier Danielle Smith and controversial street preacher Archer Pulowski, also former head of the Alberta Independence Party. And she says, I can't really do anything, but I'm talking to justice officials. I'm actually not really sure what the NDP and CBC are so upset about here. Maybe it's just a matter of hair splitting, but CBC is treating this as a big scandal, so we're going to dive into it. We're also going to talk about the federal budget that just came down from Ottawa yesterday. It is a massive, massive increase in spending over an already massive spending budget that was there. New spending across the board and new subsidies for any kind of energy except for the kind of energy that comes out of the ground and is reliable and profitable. We're also going to talk about kind of a funny one, and don't jump on me until you've listened. You know what I'm going to talk about. The CFL's Canadian player quota, you know, the quota is requiring a certain number of Canadian players on every CFL team. It's unintentionally racist. It kind of started as a joke, but then we started digging into it and studied the issue, and it's pretty funny. An affirmative action program for Canadians actually ends up resulting very directly in hiring of less black people. It's pretty funny. The CFL, before you get crazy, CFL is not racist. They're not white supremacist. None of this stuff. But their quota policy designed to help employ more Canadians in football inadvertently results in hiring of employing less black players in football. So we're going to dive into it. It's kind of a funny cautionary tale about the dangers of quotas, affirmative action, and hiring on anything other than merit. Before we get going, though, I want to thank my favorite sponsor, the Canadian Shooting Sports Association. I've been a member of the CSSA for more than a decade, trusting them with my membership dues every year to represent my interests as a firearms owner in Canada. Without the Canadian Shooting Sports Association, the federal government would have probably seized all of our firearms a long time ago. They are doing yeoman's work in protecting your right to own, use, safely purchase firearms in Canada. If you're not yet a member of the CSSA, go to cssa-cila.org or do what I do, which is much easier. Just Google them and click on membership and join today. It's worth absolutely every penny. And speaking of guns, this is not part of the script here, but speaking of guns, I think we got to give a shootout to the Nashville Police Department for their wildly efficient and quick response to the shooter at a private Christian school, I think it was, in Nashville. Marked contrast to some of the other tragic school shootings we've seen in the United States. The Nashville Police Department was there fast, went right into the school. A lot of us have seen the video footage, and these guys were like John Wick on the job.
I think it's a matter of leadership. These guys were given clear instructions, don't let what happened in Texas ever happen here, and so they went and did it. What I heard at the time, which I was saddened in the Uvalde case was that the standing operating instructions were get there, seal the area, wait for backup, but they waited an hour.
Yeah.
And I wondered if there wasn't some gung-ho fellow who could have just gone in there and
that was a combination, I think, of bad leadership setting those rules.
Yeah.
And then cowardice. Those police officers in Texas, there's a time when you disregard
exactly
rules.
You don't wait an hour.
Yeah.
You might wait 5 minutes.
I think it was Frederick the Great said, he kept on firing his generals during the Seven Years' War, and he found the general he wanted when he found a general who knew when to disobey orders, when to take initiative on the ground, and the situation calls for it, and you have to break your orders. And I don't know if there was any kind of such bizarre orders in the case of Nashville, but one way or another, I think good leadership and courage and initiative from the officers there did swift justice.
They certainly set the tone for anything like this going forward.
Yeah. All right. Well, the story's been going along for a few months now. So I guess we'll back it up. Actually, probably in some of its earliest forms, I guess we kind of touch into this a bit. I asked Danielle Smith in an interview if she was going to consider pardons or amnesty for people who had been charged with COVID-related charges, specifically anyone, non-violent, non-firearms-related stuff. And she said it was a good idea. She was going to look into it. Seems she did look into it. The advice back from the Justice Department was no, can't do that. I was surprised and disappointed, but that's apparently what Justice Department said. Then the CBC came out, did a story, and said there's emails that show Crown prosecutors have been contacted by Smith directly, and she is interfering in the prosecution of justice. And then the CBC, they got some blowback from the government. The government said it's defamatory. And then they said, actually, we never even saw the emails. We talked to people who claim to have seen the emails. And then it more or less kind of died from there for a while. It's been quiet. And then we go to today.
Well, you should mention perhaps that they did an internal search for those emails.
Yeah.
Like somebody lost their weekend over that. Went through how many thousand emails?
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah. Although the government does automatically.
Nothing was found.
The government does delete emails over time. So it's possible it wouldn't have been there. But it doesn't appear to have been there. The CBC story has not had any proof to support it yet. That doesn't mean it's not true, but hasn't been any proof to support it, which if it did go to court is not good. You got to be able to prove your story's true. Then we go to today, and the CBC and NDP, the NDP actually already had this. I think they were waiting to release it during the election, but the CBC got it, releases it today. Technically, it's a video, but it's a video of a guy on a phone call. Video of Arthur Pulowski, a street preacher in Calgary. Probably fair to say he's a controversial figure. Until also earlier today, he was the leader of the Alberta Independence Party. That party eats its own pretty quick and turfed him as leader. I guess he wasn't sufficiently something. And he's gone. It was a video of him on the phone with Danielle Smith. And long story short, he's saying, he's asking for updates on pardons, amnesty, that kind of stuff. She's saying, talk to Justice. Justice says, I can't do it. But I'm talking to Justice every day. We'll see if there's anything we can do. That's, I think, it. She didn't say I was talking to prosecutors. I could be wrong. Send us a message or in the comment section here. Let us know if I'm wrong. But I didn't see anywhere where she said she's talked to prosecutors. She said she spoke to justice officials. Now, that includes bureaucrats, deputy ministers, political advisors, and it does include potentially prosecutors, but she didn't say prosecutors. What's the story? What's the NDP and the CBC going at here? Because I'm not yet sure what they're lighting their hair on fire about.
And you can't be from what we've heard this morning. First of all, we went back to the CBC story, because when the CBC puts out something on video, they also back it up with a printed story, which is a good thing in there, you know. So they reported pushing Justice Department officials to intervene. Well, Justice Department officials, you just said it yourself, that could include prosecutors, but it doesn't say prosecutors. And no. The story is that, or the allegation is that prosecutors specifically were contacted. There has been no evidence for that. And the CBC, which is actually covering this story, has not said that either, or at least it hasn't said it in print. We listened to it this morning, and, you know, could have missed it, but I don't think it did. And there is no allegation here that Smith did anything unethical. What is unethical in this situation is for a politician to go to a prosecutor, but she's the premier. She can talk to all the justice officials, the bureaucrats in the Justice Department, talk to all of those that she wants. That's her job, and it's their job to talk back to her. And when she says, can you do something for these people, then they say, no, we can't, or you shouldn't, or you can't. Well, that seems to be the conversation that took place. No story here.
I think that's the crux of it. Now, the CBC and the NDP are coming from a place ideologically, for the most part, where they think that people who broke lockdown rules or didn't wear their mask, they should be charged. They're bad people. They committed a crime, and you should do the time. I think there's a lot of Albertans who don't share the view that the Kenney government took during that time. But I think that it boils down to, was she talking to prosecutors or was she talking to bureaucrats? Was she talking to people who are actually in charge of cases, and was she intervening on a case-by-case basis, like drop this case, don't drop that case? That would be interfering with the prosecution. That would be wrong, even if the spirit of it was correct, because these are we're on cable now, I can't swear. Even if these are BS cases. But if she's talking to just bureaucrats in charge, deputy ministers or people responsible for kind of overseeing things, there doesn't seem to be anything innately wrong with that. You think I'm getting it that right? Or is anybody angry that they talk to anyone? Or is it that just they're trying to insinuate that it was just they were talking to prosecutors?
Well, I think they're trying to insinuate. You know, I got swept up when the conference came because I thought, wow, this is CBC's dedicating 20 minutes to a live broadcast of this, and I made a mistake. I should know better. Then I went to the Twitter sphere, and oh boy, they're saying she's told him that she spoke with prosecutors, and as Nigel more responsibly looked later at the transcript, no, she didn't say that. Because had she said that to Pawlowski, well, then it would be completely contrary to what she'd responded when asked before. So, I guess it's still in question. Some people think perhaps she shouldn't be speaking to anybody who's been charged under those things, and that can be debatable. But it's quite a tempest in a teapot compared to then if she'd have been trying to influence prosecutors.
Corey, you know what would have been a worse story to come out at this point is after all that she said to encourage people who had taken a position on this, that she'd got up to Edmonton, just left them behind. There'd never even been any discussion about what could be done to alleviate the legal situation that they were in. Now, when the conversation took place, it turned out there wasn't anything. But at least she had the conversation.
I find it also, maybe let's go to the bigger level here, higher level here. I find it strange that there is nothing they can do, because these were provincial statute that they're charged under, not the Criminal Code of Canada, nothing federal. These were provincial laws. This was done under Kenney's watch and for the most part under his and Chandra's orders when Chandra was the health minister. Couldn't they have just repealed or amended this legislation? I mean, pardons and amnesty take place, not all the time, but it's not an infrequent thing. It does take place. Now, normally it's not an individual case-by-case basis. You know, like the U.S. president can pardon, they should have pardoned, I think, Snowden. They pardon a turkey every year. But they don't, but in Canada, pardons tend to be more broad-based. You know, they pardoned the wheat pirates, those pesky Alberta and Saskatchewan farmers who refused to sell their grain to the federal government when the wheat board was in place, and they went to jail for selling their grain on the private market. They were all pardoned under Harper. They're looking federally at a pardon program right now, I think for people who were charged under indecency laws, but it was really just kind of an anti-gay thing a long time ago. We've done this kind of thing before where we've identified clearly unjust laws, we've repealed or amended those laws, and then pardoned people. I'm not sure why we can't do this on a provincial level, even though it's not criminal prosecution, it's provincial statute. I don't know why we can't do that.
Yeah, it makes you want to phone up a justice official, doesn't it?
I'd like answers. Like, honestly, I'd like to see this brief because I think these people do not, you know, if you, as long as you haven't gotten violent, I can't imagine a case where any of these people truly deserve to be charged.
You know, the one thing that listening to all that was that that sort of smug moral rectitude, which oozes from so many of the NDP spokesmen, saying, shouldn't even be talking to somebody like Arthur Pulaski. You know what he is. Oh, do we? I don't know. It's a, he's a, has quite a profile, but to actually say that somebody is kind of, you shouldn't even
beneath you.
Beneath you, you know, like a responsible politician should never. It's a sad state of affairs, but I don't think it's going anywhere.
All right, we're going to turn now to the federal budget that just came down yesterday from on high in Ottawa. I mean, you remember when Justin Trudeau was running for prime minister the first time, 2015, and he said he was just going to run a little deficit. Stephen Harper's kind of little deficit. And it turned into these massive deficits. And they were certainly not temporary, as Trudeau promised. You know, as Milton Friedman said, there's nothing so permanent as a temporary government program. Mm-hmm. These temporary deficits, small temporary deficits, turned out to be massive permanent deficits. And, you know, so we've seen increase over spending. And the Liberal, you know, COVID's over. Crisis is over, but the Liberals have to find a new crisis, and that crisis is, well, we're back to global warming. So we're back on that page now. So they increased spending over the last budget by $40 billion. $40 billion. Oh, sorry, no. That's the deficit is $40 billion, I should say. $40 billion deficit, paying not for any kind of investments, really, but for regular program spending and subsidies. These are just handouts from the government to provincial governments or to corporations, corporate welfare. $40 billion deficit, and they're projected to continue running deficits literally forever. There is not even a, I remember, you know, when I was in the legislature, a finance critic, the NDP would propose these five-year budgets, and they would always show it was balanced in the last year. Now they would introduce another budget and say, ah, something happened, it's not our fault. But the new fifth year, there it shows balance. And then the third year, the NDP, they bring it up. Ah, sorry, something happened, not our fault. But the new fifth year, they did this every single year. It's the oldest trick in the book. Pierre Trudeau did it every year. Brian Mulroney did it every year. It's a standard thing for governments running deficits. You promise that eventually you're going to run a deficit, even if we know it's, I miss swearing. Damn cable. Even if we know it's BS, you at least, it's a nod to the theory that a balanced budget would be a fine and notable goal. They don't do that. They have forever deficits. These are literally legislated permanent forever deficits. So it's $40 billion deficits in perpetuity and a $20 billion increase in spending, mostly for transfer payments to the provinces, a new unconstitutional dental care program demanded by the NDP, and massive, massive corporate welfare subsidies to anyone in the energy business who is not extracting profitable, cheap, reliable energy from the ground. As long as you're not doing that, you get money. And of course, higher taxes on businesses to theoretically pay for some of it. Nigel, whose budget was this? Was this Justin Trudeau's or was this Jagmeet Singh's? Whose budget is it anyway?
No, I think it is. I think it is Mr. Trudeau's budget. He doesn't have a principled objection, I don't think, to another welfare program, which is what the dental program is. So I think when Mr. Singh said, "This is my price," he was pushing on an open door. I am not privy to the innermost workings of Mr. Trudeau's mind. None of us are. But it looks to me as though he's got some sort of a messiah complex, and it is focused entirely on climate change. He wants to be remembered as a significant figure in Canadian history, and the significance is going to come from what he did to get Canada off oil and natural gas and onto something else. So he puts the money into it, and he's going full bore at it because he knows there's a very good chance, but he's on his last lap. He may not win the next election. Depends when it's going to be and what happens in the next couple of years. But there's a very good chance he's in the end days of his term as prime minister. And rather than doing what we would call good government, he wants to get done what he wants to get done. Now, like I said, I don't know what goes inside his mind.
Some would suspect not much.
I know. Well, I've said that too. But I mean, to be charitable, why should I be charitable? This is a punditry show. No, I think that he's got the bit between his teeth. He wants to do this. He wants to be remembered for doing it, and that's where this comes from. But you know, this is what he has actually done. It took us from 1867 to 2015 to run up an accumulated national deficit in the order of $600 billion. That has been doubled in the 7.5 years that Mr. Trudeau has been prime minister. It has been utterly reckless. It has been beyond reckless. It's been irresponsible to the point of dangerous driving.
I'd agree with you for the most part about Trudeau's messiah complex, except I disagree that it's focused singularly on just global warming or climate change.
Whatever. Well, there are other things.
I think it just depends what's in the news that day. If it's Black Lives Matter, well, then it's about racial justice. If it's about truth and reconciliation, well, he'll declare a holiday and go before he goes surfing. But you know, he'll jump on these bandwagons.
Well, that's true, but he's been very consistent on climate change.
Yeah, well, I think COVID. It's about locking down and mandates and that kind of stuff. Mm. But I think that's global warming is the old faithful. When everything else, when there's nothing else burning on the social mm-hmm. justice, progressive, liberal front, if there's nothing urgently burning, kind of flaring up, he'll go back to the well of global warming as his main stay. But there was a definite piece of evidence in here about legacy, and that is that they locked in the carbon tax in a way that makes it very expensive for a future government to get rid of. Now, they already had this to an extent before. Essentially, what it means is, let's say Trudeau loses the next election, Pierre Poilievre comes in and he says, no more carbon tax. Now, there's a bunch of corporate welfare in Canada right now that is paid for by the carbon tax. So, you know, we pay, you fill up your car, some of that money goes into a fund, and Justin Trudeau gives it to corporate welfare buddies who get to spend it on different projects to make themselves money. If Poilievre comes in and shuts off that source of revenue, the federal government then needs to continue to pay these corporate welfare bums. And that'll have to come out of other sources of government revenue, your regular personal income tax, corporate tax. So it means, a future government can get rid of the carbon tax, but they're permanently going to have, at least for a very long time, going to have to continue to pay it. I know you think it's bad policy, Corey. Was it smart politics? He's locking an incumbent into his position, and that's kind of the long-term judge of political success.
You said it shows maybe a bit more of an indication that he's doing his swan song. As Nigel said, he wants some sort of legacy, so he was the guy who took on climate change and even kept his successor from managing to undo things. I mean, I don't know if Justin was bright enough to come up with that poison clause in there, but somebody did on his behalf. The problem is, I mean, as you mentioned, with these budgets, and this wasn't unexpected with a big deficit, but it's every government that does it. I mean, just Trudeau's been the worst, but this it's going to keep happening until Canadians get sick of it. That's what happened. It took until the 90s, and I think the big factor that gets talked about
bankrupt before we took it seriously
is when that principal gets so big and people see the interest payments. The interest on that this year is going to be $44 billion. That's bigger than the deficit itself.
It's up $8 billion in interest, annual interest payments over last year.
And that
billion.
Is flushed money. That upsets Canadians. I mean, that upsets me. I loathe that when I'm paying interest if I haven't paid off the balance.
Does this upset Canadians? Because Canadians, you know, as a company excluded, seem to have lost their zeal for balanced budgets and responsible
eventually
fiscal management.
It'll take a while.
Yeah, but it'll go to you, Nigel.
You had a very good line this
morning. Are Canadians
going
to have to be? Are we going to be facing bankruptcy before Canadians care about this?
Well, probably. You had a very good line this morning when we were talking about this, and you said, "Look, when every day you see a train wreck, another train wreck, doesn't seem that interesting." And I think people's eyes are just glazed over by this, by the consistency of it. And the other thing, you know, it's going to keep on going because they're in such a bind. There's only three things they can do. They can cut expenses, they can raise taxes, or they can inflate. Well, they're not going to, their whole brand is spending money. So they're not going to cut.
No.
So there's a limit to how many taxes you can charge. So I think they have to do what they're doing, which is pursue policies that devalue money. And that makes it easier to handle the ongoing expenses.
So we did see some increase in taxes on business. They've already massively hiked taxes on high personal income earners.
A carbon tax coming in?
Yeah, carbon tax. But I think they're leery of, I mean, to really bring in money, you'd have to raise the income taxes on low and medium income earners to really increase government spending. And that would make them unpopular. And so they've kind of maxed out corporate taxes. On businesses, they've maxed out, well, they haven't maxed out the carbon tax because they keep on increasing it to wild levels, which is going up April 1st. Mm-hmm. But they've kind of maxed out the taxes for the most part, unless we want to get to truly Scandinavian commie territory. Right. The only option seems to be to continue to inflate the money supply. And the money supply has been grossly inflated. I mean, inflation, I've said this before, the media and politicians mix up what inflation actually is. There's cost of living and there's inflation. They're related, but they're different. If a ship jams up the Suez Canal and that affects the supply chains and prices go up as a result, well, that's cost of living increase, but it's not inflation. Inflation is when the government debases the money supply normally in the modern world by printing more, either physically or digitally. And the federal government has direct control of that. They set the mandate of the Bank of Canada. This has happened under their watch. I think you're on to the point here. I want your feedback, Corey. Are we just destined now for a gross round of essentially monetary debasement?
I think so for a while. As I said, they only have a few options and they don't have any appetite to pursue any others. That one gives them a relatively, you know, to avoid an immediate catastrophe of massive tax hikes, and they just don't have the appetite to cut spending. So, yeah, we're going to see more of it, as I said, until Canadians say enough, and that could be a long time.
What did you make of that $460 that they're going to give people as a sort of a grocery allowance?
That's as old as to give it Ralph Bucks or Premier Smith did it here. If you could hand people a little bit of their own money back to them.
You know, don't you think it's kind of insulting? I mean, you burned through that in 2 weeks.
It was wrong, I think, when the Smith government did it here in Alberta. And it's just as wrong when the Trudeau government's doing it in Ottawa. But I don't see the media going after the Trudeau government for it. They did go after Smith for it. And I think they were right to go after it. It was vote buying.
And
they shouldn't have done that.
It's just the price of an appetizer on the governor general's plane. So, I mean, it's
cold camembert cheese for a senator.
It doesn't make that much impact. It's a token gesture. But
all
effective.
All right. This is a fun one. Now, I trigger warning for those of you who don't like people who get triggered. This story is not about the CFL being racist. It's about a policy designed to do something that's unintentionally sort of racist. So there was about 1 or 2 months ago, Nigel, we were sitting in the newsroom, kind of shooting the breeze with some of the folks. We were talking about these racial hiring quotas and affirmative action programs at the University of Calgary. And I said someone said something along the lines of, you know, if I see someone in a job or in a program and they're a part of a group that benefits from quota hiring, I just can't help but not have confidence that they're not the best person for the job. Maybe they don't deserve to be there. And that's unfair to the people who maybe do come from that group and do deserve to be there, but that group gets a quota. And then I said, yeah, it's like when I see Canadians in the CFL. It's double triggering. Canadian football fans are going to be offended by this. But we all know that the Americans, by and large, with some notable exceptions, Americans are just generally better at football because they have a wildly better football program. It's part of their culture. You want it. Doesn't really matter your income group for the most part. You know, as long as you're like above 7 years old, you want to play football in America, you got a shot at playing football. You can go all the way to the top if you're good and work hard. Not that way in Canada. So when you see Canadian football players, you know, for the most part, they're not as good. And there's a quota in the CFL that I think is 21 members of the team. So a bit under 50% have to be Canadian. And that's designed to ensure that the Canadian Football League is at least plausibly largely Canadian, if not, not a majority. And then I got to thinking after I said, yeah, you know, it's like affirmative action for Canadian players. It occurs to me that most of the Canadian players are white and most of the American players are black. And we have a quota to hire Canadians. I wonder, is this Canadian player quota unintentionally resulting in hiring less black people for the job who are better qualified for it than some of these white guys? So we did the research. One of our reporters, Jonathan Bradley, ran the numbers for me. And boy, that's what it turned out. Among the American players in the CFL, there's an average, the average team has five black or non-white players, and it's football. Mostly black players. Five black players to every one black player among Americans in the CFL. But in the Canadian side, which benefits from quotas, there's two white players to every one black or non-white player. And that means that by forcing teams to hire more Canadians than, you know, in just a totally merit-based system, the Canadian football players tend to be white and American football players tend to be black. Ergo, the CFL is racially discriminating, unintentionally. I don't believe for a minute that these guys are intentionally hiring based on race. That's not the thing, but they are hiring based on nationality. And just based on nationality, one's going to be whiter and one's going to be blacker than the other. Nigel, is there a lesson in here about unintended consequences and quota hiring here?
Well, I think there is, for sure. It is the one example that I've heard of in which a system of doing things actually does produce a result that you're probably a little embarrassed by. Does that mean that we shouldn't do it?
So that's the big question here. Yeah. Because it has a... There is a reasonable goal in that quota. It's that the Canadian Football League should have some Canadians playing in it. And as I said, CFL is the only league I watch, and I beat it up all the time. It's such a typically Canadian thing. But Canadian football is players are just not, for the most part, the caliber of Americans. There's big exceptions like BC's Rourke, incredible quarterback, Canadian, top talent. He's definitely headed for the NFL one day if he's not already signed. He actually might be. I'm not sure. The goal is to ensure the CFL is Canadian. And that makes sense, because if we didn't have a Canadian quota on a team, the CFL teams would be almost entirely American. Almost entirely American. That's the inevitable consequence of what would happen. So is it, despite the result of this having some racial skewing, is it still a good idea to keep the quota? The only alternative seems to be get rid of it and accept that the CFL would become an American game on Canadian soil.
Well, I guess it was one option is you're trying to try and persuade some Americans to become Canadian citizens.
Well, that does happen. Some longtime CFL players do become Canadians.
And but the other thing is, you know, we talk a lot about discrimination, and just the very sound of the word, people start to freak out. But we actually discriminate for a lot of reasons, and nobody complains. If you are an airline pilot, your career comes to an end at a certain age. Why do they do that? Because your health is at greater risk as you get older. So, therefore, everybody comes, I think it's 65. I think everybody stops flying commercially at 65. That's discriminatory. If Fred earns more money than Bill, Fred will pay a higher rate of income tax. That is discriminatory. But we accept that because we think that in some way it is fair. Just
as some people
think. Yeah, well, I like the flat tax in Alberta, but that to me is fairness. But I understand that there's an argument that the more you earn, the more you should contribute. So, you know, you don't have to agree with it. Most people think it's absolutely acceptable. And if that is discrimination, they're all for it. So you've got to think, when is discrimination acceptable? Because obviously some discrimination is. And I think the CFL quota system, yeah, you're right. It would just be American players playing on Canadian fields if there wasn't some way to, if it was solely on merit.
Corey, what do you think would be the best way to deal with this? Is it, because this is, if I might say so myself, little self-flattery, I think it kind of encapsulates the decision here. You either have a large contingent of Canadians playing in the Canadian Football League, and you've accepted that that's going to result in some unintentional racist hiring practices, or you're going to eliminate unintentional racist hiring practices, and you just accept it's an American team. Those are the only two kind of plausible ways I see forward, other than kind of micro quotas within the Canadian quotas, and we'd just, you know, be a laughingstock to do that.
It's difficult. Yeah, I mean, you see, I'm opposite. I watch nothing but NFL, and I can't bring myself to really enjoy CFL. I know there's some good ball and some good players, but I want to see the best. I want to see the elites. I want to see those bizarre, outstanding athletes who can tiptoe on the sideline. That's what I'm talking about, and that's why I watch it, because I know that the CFL almost purposely handicaps itself.
Pretend for a moment you care about your own, Alberta's own football teams. Pretend you care for a moment.
And I do care because I know their identity would be completely overwhelmed if you just allowed the superior base of players to flood in. And even then, they still wouldn't have a team that could compete with an American NFL.
No, it's just the money's not there to compete with the NFL.
Yeah, so they're in a tough spot. It was unintentional, as you said. Maybe just to, if anything, they want to try and develop more broad-based football player development within Canada, so we can get more up-and-coming players who are of a. But again, that won't change the racial makeup.
No.
So you've just exposed something that a beleaguered league probably didn't need to hear about.
I was very, you know, you saw, Nigel, how cringe I was to publish this, because the last thing I want to do is damage the CFL. It's the only bloody league I watch, and I know it's not the greatest league, but it's my league. I don't know what the best way forward is. I always default to merit, and for the most part, it's merit. They're obviously infinitely better football players than me, but I wanted to be a CFL player. I was like the only kid who wanted to be a professional football player who never even thought about the NFL. I was like, I want to be in the CFL. That's the best to me. I want to be a CFL football player, but like, I went to schools that didn't have football programs, so I played rugby and Aussie rules football. I always found the closest cheap things I could to football. But we just don't have the program. I don't know. Nigel, what do you think is better? Do we just go purely merit-based and accept Canadians are pretty much not playing the game? Or do we keep Canadians in the game and accept that it's kind of it's going to result in subpar outcomes in terms of fairness?
This is a little bit like asking a vegetarian whether he prefers the stock handling practices in beef or in pork, you know. I mean, it's tough, but I think this is one of those cases where, yes, you can justify the discrimination if you want to, because otherwise, simply wouldn't be much opportunity for Canadian boys to grow up and play football. By the way, you need to thank me. There were three big white guys standing at the front door looking for you this morning.
Oh,
and I said that you would be in today.
Oh, some angry white stampeder Canadian players.
They aren't weaklings, you know.
I like to fashion myself a scrapper, but got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them. I feel bad about publishing this article because and I could tell, like, in the comment sections, who actually read the damn thing and who didn't. You know, you see on Facebook, people see the headline. The CFL's Canadian player quota is unintentionally pretty racist. Well, if you don't know the Western Standard, you might just assume that's another woke headline saying everything is racist. You know, everything is racist today. No. And I could tell really quickly who has a Western Standard membership and pays to read this stuff, and who just reads the headlines and rage comments. I could see pretty quickly. Okay. My apologies to the CFL. I really am not trying to be a pain in your ass. Love you guys. And I love the Canadian players. Don't hold the Americans, but I love our Canadian football players. You're the best. In my view. My hope. Okay. Before we wrap up, though, we'll talk real quickly about this last story. The federal government, you remember during the Freedom Convoy, blacklisted a bunch of people who were involved, people, organizations, and businesses that donated or involved in any way with the Freedom Convoy, blacklisted them, ordered the banks to freeze their bank accounts, all sorts of wild stuff that belongs in third world countries, Banana Republic stuff. We knew this had happened, but just recently, maybe you fill us in more, Nigel, the federal government has admitted that they shared this blacklist with foreign governments, including enemy states like the Chinese Communist Party. They've shared the blacklist with them, asking their financial institutions to blacklist these people. God forbid that they get any kind of banking services overseas.
Yeah, well, I doubt that too many of them were dealing in South Korea, but, it's actually quite a long list. I'm crediting BlackRock's with this because it's their article, but share the blacklist in the Bank of China, the State Bank of India, BNP Paribas of France, Citibank New York, Habib Bank of Pakistan, Hana Financial Group. I won't read them all. There's about 20 foreign banks that have received the proprietorial information about Canadian companies, including their account numbers, because that's what was frozen, was the account. It wasn't don't do business with ABC Trucking. It's don't do business with ABC Trucking. And if you see anything going into this account, cut it off, freeze it. Mm-hmm. Don't move it along. I hope that the banks overseas have got good security measures in place to prevent hacking.
Well, if we're sharing it with the Chinese communists, we know they're good at hacking. I'm not sure how good they are at resisting it.
If I were in that business, I think I'd be changing my account numbers, but gosh darn it, it's already out there. This was a political prosecution. Let's face it. Mm-hmm. This went beyond anything that you could justify in criminality. And we have to face the fact that if you upset the government in this country, I hate the term weaponized, because that's just a neologism that's bad English. But that's what we're talking about. They take the systems and they use the systems against you. And here's a perfect example of it. And this is Canada. This is not the FBI going after Trump supporters.
All right. All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Nigel, Corey, thank you very much for being part of the show today. I want to thank all of you who watched today, especially those of you watching for the first time on the Wild TV Network, RD TV, and the Cowboy Channel. So glad you could join us. If you're not yet a member of the Western Standard, you need to be. The Western Standard is one of the only media left in the entire country that refuses to accept the federal government's media bailout. We exist because of advertising. I'm sure you saw some of that in the commercial clips if you're watching on the cable side, and subscriptions or memberships. So if you're not yet a member of the Western Standard, go to westernstandard.news and click on membership. It's only $10 a month or $100 a year to get you full access to all Western Standard news and our network of reporters between Victoria, BC, and Ottawa. There's nothing after that. There's nothing after Ottawa. It's just too east. So we'd appreciate your support in supporting the work we do. Thank you very much for joining us today, and God bless. Canadian Shooting Sports Association. Without the CSSA, our gun rights would have been taken long, long ago. These guys are on the front lines, helping to draft smart and intelligent firearms regulations and legislation in Canada, and more importantly, educating the public about how we keep guns out of the hands of the wrong people. To become a member, it's absolutely worth every penny. You can become a Western Standard member for just $10 a month or $99 a year for unlimited access.